Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Rapid City Journal reporter Seth Tupper walked down the street to the new SDPB Black Hills Bureau. He joins us for our weekly meeting of the Dakota Political Junkies. Seth, welcome.
Thanks for having me in your beautiful new facility.
It's here. Nice to be your neighbor.
Yeah, it is.
Another SDPB reference there. Exactly. We're neighbors now. And also with us on the phone, because it's a little too far to walk, John Hunter. He's publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Hi, John.
Just a dingy little office here, not a beautiful thing.
You should have driven out to say hi with us. We would have taken you out to lunch.
Next time.
Next time. All right. We're going to start with some work that Seth has in the Rapid City Journal, and I haven't had the chance to read through this. It looks pretty interesting, though. So set the scene for us, Seth.
Well, we've had some tips over the past several years from people who were concerned about what they alleged was basically a takeover of this little-known publicly elected board called the West Dakota Water Development District. And we finally got around to the story, and basically what's alleged is that this local conservative political luncheon group called the Wingnuts, they adopted that name for themselves after others applied it derogatorily. This group kind of took that on as their name willingly. And the allegation is that members of this group have gotten themselves elected or appointed to this West Dakota Water Development District Board to basically control it. And that has created some conflict on the board there's basically two opposing factions now on this 9-member board. And it all came to a head recently when the board voted to defund a couple of stream gauges, one above Pactola Reservoir in the Black Hills here, and the other above Deerfield Reservoir. And it was about $15,000 in funding that this district had been contributing to these stream gauges for years. And then all of a sudden there was a vote to not continue with that funding any longer.
What's a stream gauge? Explain what that is for us.
Basically what you'll see if you go out there is there's a little shack by the stream, and from that shack there's some tubes running under the stream, and there's a little bubbler under there that emits gassy bubbles, and the gauge measures the amount of pressure that's exerted on those bubbles, how much pressure it takes to emit those bubbles, and from that scientists can calculate stream flow and all kinds of other data. And there's a satellite uplink from that shack to scientists here in Rapid City, and there's a network of gauges throughout the Black Hills and all of South Dakota and the nation that are continually monitoring stream flow and flooding and things like that. And they're valuable. These particular gauges measure basically the flow from streams, from spring-fed streams in the Black Hills. They're flowing into these reservoirs. And so the data is important to irrigators downstream that use the water, to the city of Rapid City that uses the water, to recreational users, people that kayak and fish and things like that. And when these stream gauges lost funding, or appeared like they were going to lose funding, it became a big deal, and a big fight erupted on this board between these warring factions. And at the latest meeting, there was a vote to overturn that decision, and the funding was temporarily restored. But now it's already going to be on the next agenda, apparently, for the next meeting to vote on it again, because because of these two warring factions on this board, neither side wants to give up. So,
John Hunter, let's bring you into the conversation. Some sharp divisions, warring political factions, sounds sort of familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, it could be any time in our country's 240-year history. Where you get, especially on smaller boards that may be easier to get on, is, as Seth was saying, this is a kind of a little-known board before, and so it may have been easier to get on that and then try to make changes from that. I think there's, it's probably not terrible that you have two different groups. In other words, that they may not vote unanimously on every single issue. That's not bad in itself, but if people are going there for reasons other than to serve the constituents they're supposed to serve, in other words, it's a maybe a personal vendetta or something else, then it starts to get messy.
I'm curious about this term wingnuts, and it's not the first time I've heard it. I'm sure it won't be the last. Seth, what are your thoughts on, is this business as usual in politics and small boards, or are you seeing a microcosm of something larger?
It's a microcosm of something larger. I mean, this is a group that's been around for a number of years now in Rapid City, but it's very influential in politics in the Black Hills. number of the people who go to these weekly luncheons, Wingnut luncheons, have run for office, and some have won. You know, at the county level, at the legislative level, they've run for school board, they've run for county commissioner and county offices and things like that. So they're very active, and this seemed to be a new high watermark, so to speak, in their ability to influence a board, rather than just getting a couple of members elected and having a voice. Here they actually seem to have control of this board for this moment when they voted to defund these gauges. That's the allegation of the people who don't appreciate what the people from the Wingnuts group are doing. Now, when you talk to them, the people that are part of the Wingnuts who are on this board, they'll say that they're just being good stewards of taxpayer dollars, and they think this is funding that perhaps is that these gauges could be operated more cost effectively by other agencies or other groups like state government. Right now the gauges are operated by the U.S. Geological Service. So that's kind of the battle. But yes, it is. It's kind of a microcosm of the broader battle in the country between both people that are more conservative and more liberal and differing views on science and the value of science and the cost of doing that science. And so, yeah, it's kind of very emblematic of all of those things.
How have you seen this conversation in Rapid City, for example, impact conversations in Pierre?
Well, this particularly impacted conversations in Pierre because the state DENR, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, also uses stream gauge data and contributes funding to run some of the stream gauges throughout South Dakota. So I did interview somebody from that department, and they were hoping that this funding would be continued because one of the things that the people on the board who opposed the funding said is they kind of want the state to take over the gauges maybe and do it more cost effectively. Well, people in state government told me we don't want to do that. We have enough to do already. So so there is an impact that ripples beyond locally.
So John Hunter, we talked last week with other junkies. I can't remember. Roger Whittle was here last week. Dana Ferguson as well, about terms and using specifics. And I'm wondering what you think of this term wingnut, as it's claimed, self-described wingnut. Do you think that's useful to sort of have, these group affiliations that people cling to, and or is it too vague to sort of say, well, who are they? What do they believe in?
No, but I do find the naming of these things to be fascinating. Of course, today you have political action committees all over the country being formed, especially kind of at the national level, that put in great names that you almost can't argue with. You know, America is number one, or freedom for everyone. I mean, who knows what these names could be, whereas their underlying mission may be something different from that. The Growth Club, I mean, it sounds like something that Costco would have or something. So, the Wingnuts, I think, and I don't know them at all, and Seth does, but I would guess that, we talk about right-wing or left-wing kind of people, and I would guess this would be considered a right-wing group, and then nuts, of course, being kind of crazy, and so we're kind of crazy this way, and again, derogatorily used at first, but maybe that's a badge of honor. It says, yeah, we're far right, and we're a little crazy, and so we're going to use this, but there's crazy names all over the country. This is some of them much worse than others, and I would guess that's where this one is.
Seth, do you think it's tongue-in-cheek and playful, or do you think it's a badge of honor?
It's a badge of honor. Yeah. Originally, the name, like I said, was critics of this group derogatorily called them the Wingnuts. And I think that the attitude was, oh, you think we're crazy for having these views? Well, then I guess we are, and we'll gladly claim the mantle and the label, and we'll own it. And so it's been kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing ever since. But they're definitely proud to, whereas I think their critics thought they'd be ashamed to admit to some of the views they have, they say, no, we're proud of our views, and we'll gladly carry that label.
So. All right, let's talk a little bit about open primaries then, as we sort of dig into these distinctions between conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat. Paul Higbee is coming up after the break. We'll talk about Tom Barry, who was a Democrat governor. John, open primaries and national nonprofit pledging $140,000 to help give that campaign a boost. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's, as we can all guess, there's frustration with partisan government overall, and people are trying to think of solutions and saying, look, whatever this political process where you have two parties, each of them nominate candidates who are thoroughly entrenched in the party philosophy, and then they can't get along at the next level, whether it's in the Congress, two chambers of Congress, or the Congress and the White House, or whatever. So I think people are just trying to struggle with anything they can do to have better government than we have today. So this idea, at least, would be that you wouldn't have party labels when you'd meet. You'd have what's called an open primary, where anyone would be in that, and then the top two candidates would be in some sort of runoff. So it could be two Republicans or two Democrats or whatever would be in that kind of thing. And so the idea is that primary voters, again, if a third of the people are independent, so the other two-thirds are electing very partisan candidates, that you don't get those kind of moderate, middle-of-the-road people that maybe that independents would like to see. So it's another idea. I mean, there's plenty of ideas out there. You know, more money for campaigning, maybe government-sponsored, less money for campaigning, outlawing contributions. I mean, there's all sorts of things that people are trying, I think, with the frustration of some of the partisan stuff that's going on.
Seth, who benefits from an open primary? Is it the voters that benefit? Is it certain candidates?
I have to think at first blush that the Republican Party in South Dakota would benefit greatly from this, because if you're just going to have everybody run in an open primary and then the top two finishers advance to the general election regardless of party, I would think in a lot of cases in South Dakota you'd have two Republicans advancing and no Democrat advancing to the general election. At least now with a partisan primary, if you're a Democrat, you have a chance through your own party's primary to get on the ballot and be on the ballot in the general election. Whereas, you know, under this system, I would have to think it would be, in some cases, more difficult for a Democrat to run, because this would open it up to as many Republicans who want to run could run, and then if they finish in the top two, they move on to the general election, and you get two Republicans running against each other rather than a Republican Democrat. So from that perspective, I don't, if it's supposed to make things less partisan, it perhaps could backfire and make it more partisan.
How about this notion of a ballot initiative coming back? Certainly not the only topic that we saw at the last election, raising its head again, and the outside money coming in. Seth, you want to start with what does that mean, that, $140,000 comes to this campaign?
From out of state, yeah. I think it just means that, if you're going to have initiatives and referendums like we have, I think you're just going to have to swallow the fact that you're going to have some problems with it, with out-of-state money and people trying to force their views on South Dakotans. I always bring this up. Marcy's Law in the last election was a perfect example of a California billionaire wanting a law passed in all of the states. So he paid all the money and got that law passed in South Dakota. There's a task force right now at the state level that's trying to deal with some of those issues. But I just think if you're going to have initiatives and referendums, you're always going to have some problems like that. You can try to manage it the best you can, but if people want to influence ballot issues here from out of state, they're going to be able to do it. I mean, I think the only way to absolutely stop that is to quit having initiatives and referendums, and you don't hear much support for that. So right. I think it's just a problem that we're going to have to deal with.
And the ballot initiative and referendum meeting is today. You can listen to it live on SD.net. Chair Emily Wanless is going to be on our program tomorrow. John Hunter, thoughts on how that referendum committee, ballot and initiative referendum committee, is sort of going, and some of those early conversations to sort of preserve citizen democracy but shore up some of the challenges?
Well, I think that summarizes it pretty well, Lori, that they're trying to get something that more people agree on, and they are breaking it down into a lot of different parts, which to me is a good sign in the fact that let's make a fair number of small changes here rather than throwing the whole thing out or overdoing it, stomping on freedom of speech and other such things. So just the glance that I took at a look at some of those things that they're debating, they look like let's address this in a small way, let's address this in a small way. Now, there's a lot of sausage making yet to go between now and when a governor would sign something next March. So you'd have to, these task forces would need to be drafted into a bill. Someone needs to sponsor it. It gets debated, goes to committee, amendments, goes to the other chamber. I mean, there's a long ways to go with those. But I do think that I don't think it's as terrible as some people say that we have a lot of initiatives or a lot of referendums. I think that's encourages citizens to vote and to get involved in government. Yes, it can go overboard. And personally, I thought that it frankly is a little too easy to change our state's constitution. That's not to say we shouldn't have, you know, maybe lower thresholds for setting laws and state statutes and referring things that are passed. But the idea of a constitution really is it should be somewhat of a framework that can stay in place for the long term. And to change that frequently or to have low threshold to change that is discouraging. But without discouraging that kind of same process that you could do by initiating a law or referring a law with a lower threshold.
All right, Seth, let's go ahead and talk about statues coming down in Rapid City. Some folks want to tear down Bill Clinton's statue on the fine corner here in your beautiful downtown area. Is this something that people in Rapid City are aware of and sort of responding to in some way?
Oh, sort of aware of it. I mean, in some ways, it's just white noise with people, you know, capitalizing on everything that's going on with Confederate statues right now and seizing an opportunity to say, well, hey, why don't we tear down Bill Clinton's statue as well? But, you know, those statues are all funded by private donations, and I assume they have, you know, permission from they've been there long enough, we don't do much reporting on them anymore, but I assume they all have permission from the city to be in the public right-of-way on the sidewalk, so... So, if you know, that would be the decision of whether the city wants to allow them to be there anymore.
How long does it take for them to come up? When does a President Obama statue or a President Trump statue appear?
They only do them after the term has ended. So the Obama one, the last we did do a story on that, I think last year, that was underway, that statue. And I don't know the reasoning behind it, but we stated in that story that they only put the statues up after the president is done serving. So the Trump statue won't be in progress until... after it's done. But this does give me an opportunity to tell a funny story. These statues, if you live and work in downtown Rapid City, you see all kinds of crazy things with these statues. But the Richard Nixon statue is just back here on an intersection not far away. And earlier this summer, I saw a middle-aged couple taking a picture where the what appeared to be the wife was strangling Richard Nixon from behind, and the husband was taking a picture of it. So there's a lot of fun that's had with those statues, and some of them have been vandalized over the years because people don't like the politics of a particular president or whatever, but there hasn't been a local movement that I know of to take any of them down. It's been more of an outside movement, you know, capitalizing on the Confederate issue.
Sure. So. John Hunter, the thought of presidential statues and how they should be respected.
Well,
I know you have something to say about this.
Yeah.
For
some reason you guessed that. Well, it's a little, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the debate we had last year on currency. And the presidents or leaders or great people or whatever in America who are on currency and statues kind of the same way. Trust me, the search for a perfect person is doesn't take very long. There have been none of our presidents so far have been perfect. Some of them have been great in some ways, some have been good, some have been lousy, but they're all presidents. And you know, if you say this guy did this thing, let's tear it down, well, you can find faults with all of them, frankly. So I think Rapid City chose to, since its heritage of with Mount Rushmore and so on, chose to honor presidents regardless of what party they were in or regardless of their success as president or their own personal faults or anything else. So let's put statues up of all of those, and I think that's okay. And vandalizing thing, in my opinion, is kind of always wrong. You can make statements about something and protest some things without damaging things. But as Seth was saying, with the whole Confederate statue thing going on, this is a cousin to that, and it'll be some news somewhere, I'm sure.
The perfectly imperfect John Hunter and Seth Tupper. Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us today. We appreciate your time. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Lori.
Yep, you're welcome.